if you want a racer, there is only one person that you can employ, which is going to pretty much guarantee you sort of payback on your investment.
Steve Jones.
Why are you picking on me?
What type of lifestyle are you selling me, Steve? Like, do you know what a KOM is? I feel like you misunderstood what a KOM is.
Are you going on your e-bike and putting it down as a run? Ferg's got a pretty big bump.
Welcome to episode 3 of the Global Mountain Bike Show. I think we're getting into the swing of things, guys. I'm Neil Donoghue. I'm joined by James Pickering in the corner and Steve Jones sat in the middle.
What does getting into the swing of things actually look like, Don?
I don't know, but we are going to talk about big earnings in the pro mountain bike world and also debate whether there should be a minimum wage structure like there is in road cycling. We're going to argue about Strava, I think. If it matters, are we bothered, etc.
Are you bothered?
I'm not bothered. No, I can argue that point straight away. And also, we're going to talk about what Owen says is the hardest bike race in Europe.
Is it, James?
Definitely not.
Right, so kicking off with £1 million salaries in mountain biking. So word on the street is that these happen. I've heard from reliable sources, particularly in cross-country world, but also in downhill. You've got to think of the people like your Nino Schurters, your Loic Brunies, are earning really good money, although they're not public with those necessarily. Actually, Aaron Gwynn in the past, I think, has said that he has earned that much money back in the Specialized days, I believe. Mm-hmm. Pretty impressive stuff, Steve, but nothing to you, I suppose.
just one point. Will World Cup winners be being paid in pounds these days? I can't think of a British rider who's going to be... No. Dominating. Surely it's going to be dollars and euros these days,
exactly,
right?
Exactly that, yeah. So we'll have to get international with this, won't we, Steve?
Yeah. I guess the first point is, what numbers have we actually got out there? Who are these people?
Well, it's good. I think not many people have gone public. Mm-hmm. Valentina Hall has in the past said she was on 100,000 euros, or dollars actually maybe, from YT. She's changed teams since then because YT went bust, which is obviously good money, but it's, you know, for a top elite woman racer, that is a tenth of particularly what the men can get. And I presume there are less women as well getting money like that. So there is a gap there still, but there aren't many racers who've come public with what they're earning.
I guess there's two things we need to talk about is what type of... Are we talking mountain bike racing? Are we talking mountain bike as a whole? And what about the crossover riders? What about the likes of Matthew Van Der Poel and, you know, Pidcock? I mean, they're probably on four million quid a year as well. So they're mountain bikers, right?
I forgot Tom Pidcock's numbers.
Tom Pidcock's somewhere speculating around 2.8 million at the moment. Oof. So when he joined Q36.5, that's in conjunction with Pinarello, he's on like a sort of multi-deal to do cyclocross, road and mountain biking. But that is a pretty lucrative contract for him. But... You've got to remember, he's won Alpe d'Huez stage in the Tour de France. He's won a lot of World Tour road races. The mountain biking thing for him, even though he's a double Olympic champion, that's not going to be earning him his money.
Well, there is obviously the crossover between cross-country road, which we'll get into in a minute. But actually, we need to talk about the sort of economics of this, because what is Q36, whatever it is? What even is, who is paying the money?
So Q36.5 is a clothing manufacturer. It's owned, I believe, by the same guy who's also got a co-share and now Pinarello. So there's a businessman who owns a few companies now. He's invested a lot of money in cycling in the last year. So Tom actually left Ineos, which is like, I guess, the Man United of cycling teams.
And Ineos, the brand, is like a big chemical, petrochemical company. Yeah. They do all sorts of stuff. So, and you can see why they have the money to pay these riders, I suppose.
Jim Ratcliffe is one of the richest people in the whole of UK, I believe.
Lives in Monaco,
yeah. He also is a big shareholder of Man United now.
Yeah.
So he invested a lot into Ineos cycling team, hence why they had a big budget. But Tom left them, joined Q36.5. as like what was a smaller team, but it's had a lot of investment recently.
I think it's careful don't get carried away with it being racing, because you know you got Van der Poel and Pidcock, and then we've talked about Bruni, talked about Valentina Hall, but then you know you got the likes of Fabio Wibmer and Danny McCaskill and Matt mm-hmm. Jones and Sam Pilgrim, all these people. Then some of them are not actually racers, right?
And so I think
mountain bike money is another place other than racing.
the economics of this from a mountain bike perspective, bike companies sell bikes, there becomes a marketing budget, they spend that how they wish. Now, companies like Commensal have got someone there called Max who loves racing. That bike company has a huge heritage in mountain bike racing and love the actual process, the image and developing bikes, and seem happy to spend the money, you know, reinvest the money in their racers. But not every brand is the same. Not every brand has a race team.
I think, if we just, one small part of mountain bike racing is downhill. Downhill is, I think, still regarded as the blue ribbons of mountain bike race events, would you say?
There's a big buzzer goes off. If anyone ever says it's the Formula One, they go, murr, murr.
I hate that.
But I think if we start, I mean, mountain biking is a relatively sort of young sport still, right? Yeah. If you look back, it started in the 90s, racing started in the 90s, cross-country downhill progressed into dual slalom and four cross, and then it kind of diversified into enduro and marathon, and you could probably chuck in free ride in the early 2000s as well, right? But now there's so many riders wanting a slice of each brand's pie, right? So yeah. It's becoming less, would you say?
I agree. It's a young sport, but you've got to think, I mean, this, I don't know enough about it, but I'll say it, but a sport like paddle seems like quite new, but I bet there's money flowing out.
Hold on. Paddle, you know, is it, a sport?
I bet there's money. Thing? I bet there's no.
What's paddle?
It's like a game of... It's cross between like tennis and squash. Court.
But I bet there's money flowing into that. I bet there's money flowing into athletes of that, even though that, to me, I don't know enough, but I bet there is. I bet, you know, mountain biking is a relatively old sport compared to some things, and it hasn't really matured in the same way. So if we're looking at road cycling, it's got a huge professional following.
Yeah.
You know, you could compare it to football, where there are fan clubs probably of the big riders. You can watch it on your mainstream networks in France and Italy. You can pay-per-view for it as well. You know, it's pay to stream it, should I say. And you can with mountain biking, but obviously I think the numbers of viewers are a lot lower, and that's probably how this is playing out. Because in road cycling, you do have a lot of outside sponsors, like your Q36.5s. Your MapEye,
Sudal.
Outside companies. I don't really know who they are, but it's not a cycling company providing all the money here.
Yeah. I mean, you spoke earlier about how many people are actually on a world tour cycling team.
Yeah, so like most world tour cycling teams and Pro Conti and continental level, there'll be 20 to 30 riders on a team. And there'll be, I mean, this isn't correct, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there's around 10 to 12 world tour teams. There'll be another 10 to 12 Pro Continental teams. And then there's a load of continental teams below that. So there is a lot more spots for professional riders in road cycling, I guess, as well. But that means also professional road cyclists get paid more and there's a lot more of them as well. So the money's got to go further.
What is that minimum wage for a pro?
So for a world tour rider, they break it down into two levels. So you have something called a Neo Pro in road, which is basically if you're in the first 2 years of your contract and you're under 25, there's a Neo Pro, and then you have a veteran pro. I believe it's around €45,000 for a veteran world tour rider, which I'd imagine if you're earning €45,000 in mountain biking as a racer, that would be pretty good salary.
I think there's probably quite a few people in that now. Yeah, particularly, I know in downhill, people talk about it.
Is a veteran over 60?
No, I'm afraid not. Not in world tour racing. That's just someone who's not in the first 2 years. I don't think you'll be doing any world tour road cycling anytime soon.
Oh, thanks, James.
I turned pro in 2000.
Did you?
And there were people earning big money there. Not many in downhill, but there were the people like Sean Palmer's that were renowned for earning pretty good money.
More outside sponsors
there was,
then?
Yeah, there was Mountain Dew, Diesel, Volvo. There were quite a few. Mm. I was sort of a mid-level pro in the doldrums of mountain bikes. It didn't add up to much money. But I think now it's back on the rise, and yeah, here are these big contracts. But I think in the middle as well, these people are earning all right money compared to where I was doing it.
Yeah, I think we look back to the 90s, it was, to answer your question, it was a massive technological curve.
Yeah.
You know, suspension went from 100 mil to like 180, 200 mil. Yeah. They were literally juggernauts in the pits. It was insane. Like, you know, massive Arctics there. Like the Don says, you know, Diesel, Grundig, Volvo, Subaru, they all went at part of it, right?
I presume we're all on the same page. We'd like pros to earn more money, or more pros to earn money at least. But, and I think I've seen that in comments elsewhere on the internet, but I'd like to know how, because I'm quite, I don't know if pragmatic is the right word, but I think people expecting money is, it doesn't sit well with me. Like, you've got to find the money somehow. And if people aren't happy with paying to watch it, however that, you know, it might be quite a lot of money, to be fair, for some regions.
30 quid a year is okay.
30 quid a month in some places. What? Which is, yeah, is quite a lot of money. And Warner Bros. Discovery kind of played the card when they took it over that, you know, they'll get these figures, the viewing figures up. So then these, what they call an endemic, I believe, outside of the bike sponsors will come in, the money will flood in, and eventually it will find its way to the pros. In my, well, from my eyes, I can't see that happening. At the moment, we have Ford, Decathlon Ford,
XC team.
And we have Norco Adidas downhill team.
Yeah.
That, as far as I can tell, they're the only sort of big outside sponsors we've got.
There's a few XC teams like Thomas Maxon, who you rode with Flickr in the year. They've got like a BMW partnership, but that's their team only. And I probably wouldn't imagine that's a big financial partnership. It's probably just supplied with some cars.
But I think, you know, to answer your point, there's a massive amount of riders who do it for the lifestyle, to be to want to take part in a world level event. And I think that's cool. You know, you've got, there's so many riders out there, you know, maybe in the UK, you've got the likes of, you know, Adam Brayton, he'd have raced during the summer and he'd be an electrician in the winter. Job done.
There are plenty of people living in the back of the vans and loving it and traveling around, and that is probably getting more difficult, which on one hand is a bit sad, but also if you are trying to make it more professional sport, at some point it's going to have to happen where that is difficult.
I guess looking at, you know, I guess we're sort of biased towards down a little bit because that's where we come from. But like, there's a lot of people made pretty good living out of Downhill, don't you? Like some of you mentioned, Palmer and Petey, Lopes, Minard.
But they're quite business savvy as well.
Exactly.
They're not just taking their money, buying Porsches and driving around. They're investing it into businesses, right?
So, but like, if you think of it from a brand's perspective, they want, you know, certainty. If they're going to invest in a rider, and this is a true story, like, it's another YT story, which I've got quite a few of them, a few bottles of wine in a cellar in Spain, this one was, and they said, okay, Steve, you know, you've written good reviews about our downhill bike. What we need now is someone to endorse that on a really high level. And I said, look, if you want a racer, there is only one person that you can employ, which is going to pretty much guarantee you sort of payback on your investment.
Steve Jones.
And he's already paid me. That's Aaron Gwynn.
Oh, yeah,
and
I said,
if you get Aaron Gwynn, there's a good chance that that he'll win your World Cup Series.
Did he win a World Cup Series on a YT?
He did. So basically, Stefan and Marcus, they phoned me up and they go, this was 6 months after the conversation in a cellar in Spain. They said, we signed him. Mm-hmm. He says, we're on our way over to the Ostrich to have a session. And we recorded it all. It's hilarious.
I'm surprised you can remember anything from that cellar in Spain, actually.
We recorded all this.
Did you?
And but the point is Gwynn went to Lourdes. I think he won the first World Cup, but he won the series, I think, two times for YT. So it all comes back to brands want certainty. And there's probably, if you look at the last, I don't know, 10 years, you've got Gwynn, Bruni, Goldstone and Piron. They're probably your certainties, right? I think in the men's downhill, at least. I don't know what it is in cross country, it's going to be Nino Schurter, right?
Yeah, Nino Schurter dominated, but now there's like, it's a bit more up in the air who's going to win each week, I guess.
Is Rhodes sucking up some of the talent out of the cross country world as
well? I think so. Like, Alan Hafferly famously won world championships for Cannondale Factory Racing. You thought, wow, this guy's got a great career as a mountain biker. Next year, he signed for Jayco Alula as a World Tour road rider.
For presumably
a lot more money, yeah. And he still races mountain bikes. He won the world championship in XC the following year. But the money is so much more in the road. You've got to think, if you could earn 100K as a mountain biker or 300K as a road rider, would you not? You'd earn 300K, wouldn't you?
It seems like the particularly cross-country athletes kind of, they live and die their career by their athletic
ability,
Whereas downhill, they seem to find a way of holding on for longer, riding e-bikes or being pros I mean, Nino's kind of an ambassador now where he's doing it, but he's still racing. But do you know what I mean?
When you say holding on for longer,
Is that what you've been doing, Steve? Holding on.
And my colleague here. Yeah. Right? Let's not forget that. Yeah. But then holding on, I mean, there's me and the Don. I'm at the extreme end of holding on.
Really
but I'm holding on for grim death. Okay, the thing is, right, I bet not name any names, but there's a few ex-World Cup downhill racers that have said to me they're actually doing better now than when they were racing.
Because, what, like you said, like other positions in the industry.
Still with helmet partners or with suspension partners or bike partners, but they're not racing, but they're doing...
Ambassadors.
Exactly, yeah. And there's a lot of them, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess a bike manufacturer invests in a rider or anyone to sell more bikes. So it doesn't have to be a racer. If someone else is going to sell you more bikes, it doesn't have to be the guy winning a World Cup, does it?
That's an interesting conversation. I mean, how many more of those are there now than there were previously?
Yeah, when you were in the 90s, if you wanted to sell bikes, you invested in racers. Whereas now, there's like...
Yeah,
like
how many lifestyle athletes was probably Hans Rey? That's probably it.
Yeah.
back in the 90s.
Would have you been a good lifestyle athlete, Steve?
What type of lifestyle are you selling me, Steve?
Well, okay, if you want to go down that road, if you guys want to pursue that, who's buying mountain bikes, right? People are actually buying e-bikes at the moment. Mm. So... you got old bloke like me who rides an e-bike.
And cross-country bikes, I think in Europe, particularly cross-country market, is still very strong.
And that's a good point. It's like, why are we paying downhill athletes so much money when brands aren't looking to sell downhill bikes, are they?
Cross-country athletes aren't cool, I'm afraid.
I think people like Charlie Aldridge and like Luca Martin are doing a good job at changing that. But I'd agree, yeah, probably for the last decade or so.
Is it time we transition to our debate about Strava?
Go for it.
Don?
Yeah, well, this has come around because, Si Richardson over on our sister channel, which is called GCN, did he quit Strava for a while to get
away
for
4 weeks? Yeah.
4 weeks. And, you know, I use Strava, actually. I do record my rides, but... I don't live or die by it, but James, I believe you're a big fan because actually we went out last week filming something and you were very excited about getting, was it a top three?
Top five.
Down one of my local trails, which I was surprised by because I was following you.
Surprised by because I'm bad at riding?
Well, I didn't think it was all that.
No.
Well, I did. But yeah, I find it quite an interesting concept nowadays that people really get into it. Steve, you look like you love Strava.
I do. I don't
cut
know if
corners
I...
on purpose to get the comms.
You know I wouldn't do that, but I don't know if I told you, I've started running the last 18 months.
God.
I actually use Strava quite a lot, to see my progress going from, because it's like there's KOMs every week, basically.
Presumably.
When you start off. But
do you know what a KOM is? I feel like you misunderstood what a KOM is.
Are you going on your e-bike and putting it down as a run?
So, do you know what I find really interesting about Strava is when you see the heat maps, right?
Mm.
And it's basically everyone is honeypotting around trail centres and bike parks. You know, what's happened to people exploring out in the hills? If you see like, you know, Brecon Beacons or North Wales, there's very few people doing that.
I would actually argue that point because I think now heat maps, I could go to a new area, say I drive up to Scotland tomorrow, and I don't need to find a local now to show me the trails because I go on Strava heat maps and I know, well, there's this area and heat maps shows me where the most ridden trails are. So I'm like, great. I would actually say it's better because you don't have to go to a trail centre now. You can find where the locals ride. But then I guess that's a problem as well because a lot of mountain bike trails are probably not on sanctioned land and heat maps are exposing where these illegal trails are. But
you'd be surprised how little activity goes on local trails. I mean, where I live on the border between England and Wales, it's a non-official area, but it is hot on the heat map.
Yeah.
But what I'm talking about is the proper out of the way places. People don't seem to do that as much these days.
What do you think? Do you think it's good, the heat maps or?
Heat maps, I've never really used, I don't think.
Yeah.
I can see why you would, but also I've heard people saying, I've actually had it the other week. Someone said to me, you know, there's some good trails just down the road, but you can't film on it and don't record it on Strava because for good reason, they want to keep them to fresh or maybe they're in a forest where they're not necessarily 100% allowed, but they're locals and they've always ridden there and it's sort of, you know, fine.
So I got a good little story. So I've been building the trails now for 30 years. Part of why I get paid.
Okay.
But I built this trail, right? And well, I didn't build, I don't build trails. The trails that I build are literally scratched in, they're deer tracks. I'm not into digging the ground up because...
Go around a jump. There's a jump on the track.
I've won a national event by going around a jump. Yeah, I'm proud of that. But like, you know...
In the boomer class.
I didn't even know what boomer class is, dude. What is a boomer class? Mike, can you help me with this? So I built this track, right? I scraped this track in and I did it and I rode it a couple of times and then I kind of forgot about it. And I don't know what happened. It was 2 years went by, right? Mm. And I went back there and this trail that I scratched in was the most amazingly worn-in trail you will ever ride. It was loamy, it was rooty, it had beautiful flow to it. Mm. And someone had found my route on Strava and they just, once, you know, it's kind of domino effect, isn't it?
Yeah.
Once someone does it. And I think there is, I thought it was cool to see it sort of, evolve.
Yeah, there's other problems with Strava, isn't there? There's a whole segment debacle. And this has been like a thing for years of people set a Strava segment and people just cut corners because they want
that's
to get
the problem
that's
I've seen.
That's cool, right?
At my trails. For quite a while, there was one track where I would just
keep blocking off.
Yeah. But then you're just losing a battle. Eventually, it just becomes a straight line.
That is uncool, isn't it?
Yeah, I
think it's disrespectful as well.
It's just like, I don't know, I love Strava. I've like... Every single bike ride I do, I record on Strava. And I love going for segments as well. But it's like, are you really going to ruin a mountain bike trail to beat someone on a Strava? Maybe if I beat you again, Neil.
How accurate are these?
Well, they're terrible.
Because there was a time when I was quite a fast racer.
Are you debating that time where he's like 10 seconds?
No, not that one, not that one. But there was a trail by me and I was like, you know, I was legitimately quite fast. And
were
quite
you?
Fit. Yeah.
Right.
And someone was like... 5 seconds faster on like a 50-second track and everyone else was within, you know, they're on the same second. And I was like, and I know who it was.
So did you have it out with him in the pub?
And I was like, he must be throwing his phone or something because he's nowhere.
Is that what you do? But, you know, one other side of a Strava thing is if people don't go to races but they want to do something by themselves, I think it's okay that have that opportunity to do that.
Yeah, Strava is super important for people like me who had a really average racing career but want to feel good about themselves.
So you're an average racing career. Seems at odds with the Don's racing career, who's hero status.
Yeah, well, it probably is in relation to Don's.
Okay,
Don's top 10 at World Cup and I top 10 at national event. So I guess...
Got top 10 on a Strava segment there? So
yeah, I guess I'll put that on the CV.
I like Strava.
Strava athletes, that's what we need.
Yeah.
Surely this, if we're looking for millionaire athletes, well, someone with the most comms.
It's funny that, because I was speaking to Si Richardson and he said his platform of like social media that has the most followers is his Strava. He says he's got more followers on Strava than he has on Instagram.
Why?
So it's like...
But you can't monetize it.
Well, that's the thing. He's making zero money out of
all
it.
All that effort.
Yeah. What do you think, Steve? You've lover or hater of Strava?
What do I think of Strava? Yeah, I'm into it, actually. In fact, lots of things, such as trail forks. We did a ride a few years ago in Liguria where we traced all the black trails down this coast.
Yeah, nice.
We rode in Alba not so long ago. So yeah. I think, you know, to be able to explore different parts of the world, definitely good tools for people to use.
Yeah, it makes it a lot easier, doesn't it?
Actually, on the subject of exploring parts of the world, we've got a new... partnership to us,
yes,
didn't we?
Nice to announce that we've got Atlas Ryko who have partnered with us. They're a mountain bike holiday provider all over the world. They've got locations. They've got Whistler, Tuscany, Slovenia, Spain, Wales, Scotland, France, all over the place.
It's about the experience, isn't it? Rather than just
like,
or as much as the ride.
Well, a bit like Elba, I suppose. It's about the experience as much as
I don't want to experience that again.
So they've got guides, they've got amazing facilities, bike chalets,
and they're proper mountain bikers, right? And so they know the local trails in a local area. It's all accommodated for mountain bikers. You're not staying in like a normal hotel. These guys really get it.
No hotel that you're staying in has been normal. I think it was great from an e-mountain bike perspective is like there is great risk going into the mountains with an e-mountain bike and not knowing where you're going because you could come across some ridiculous climbs you can't get up, so you end up pushing an e-bike. So having a guide is a really cool thing to have.
Yeah, great to have them on board. And actually, myself and Ferg are heading out to Finale Ligure in just a couple of weeks, actually, to experience a bit of their hospitality and ride some of their trails as well.
It's all about the experience.
Right, now we have Owen the Bike Nerd has joined us for Endurance Chat. You're pitching this idea as the hardest bike race in Europe. Tell us about the Highland 550, Owen.
The Highland Trail 550 in Scotland. I'm going to pitch for it. It's the hardest off-road ultra in Europe.
Okay, you've changed your tone on this.
Have because I?
We had a chat before this and you said it's the hardest bike race in Europe. And now
I think you could still argue that.
I know nothing about it. So it's a mountain bike race in Scotland, 550-somethings.
Yeah, 550 miles, that's 900k, depending on how metrically inclined you are. 52,000 feet of climbing, which is like 16 kilometres of climbing, just vertical.
I guess that's the story. That tells you what you're riding over, I suppose. And it's a bang goes the gun, everyone goes off at the same time.
Exactly that, yeah. Self-supported. So
how long does this take?
If you're really, really, I mean, guidance is that you can tour this route because it's like an FKT. The route is there. You can do it any time you want.
So someone will check your GPX.
Have a spot tracker, which you, so you can, there's the whole dot watcher thing where you can watch people race at the same time. Yeah. But you could FKT it. The conditions would be different. It wouldn't necessarily, I don't think, be a course record, but that's semantics. It is just a huge event in terms of distance. You're out in the middle of nowhere. You've got to take everything with you. So if you suddenly want a chocky milk halfway round, well,
you're allowed to ride to the local co-op or the spa to get a chocky milk. But obviously, it's not great for your racing.
Exactly. That's why it's really fun, is that you've got a plan ahead. You've got a plan in nutrition. And for me, that's why it's super hard. And it's in Scotland. So Scotland, not known for its beautiful sunny beaches. I mean, some days they can be beautiful sunny beaches, but then the next day it might be freezing rain, or it might be freezing fog, or it could
and
be windy.
And you're sleeping in a ditch if you want to sleep, or some people just crack on.
I think I follow Bryn Appleton on Instagram, and I think he said he had like 4 hours sleep, only two nights in a bivy bag. Like,
yep.
The weather looked shit, for want of a better word.
So are we saying this is the hardest race or the worst race in Europe? Midges.
Well, maybe that's
no
why it's the hardest
milk,
race. Yeah, exactly.
Ditches. Although I'm sure it is beautiful, but it does sound like a very difficult thing.
It does. And I think what I find really interesting is that I'm still pitching it as the hardest race, and we can come back to have a discussion about that. But the sort of backstory of it is also fascinating. Alan Goldsmith, who is a kind of like notable endurance racer in his own right, he went and rode the Tour Divide early on, I want to say in the kind of mid-2000s. It wasn't yet as big as it is now. Mm-hmm. And he rode that, I guess, inspired by people like Jen Hopkins and others who'd done it here in the UK, or done the race in the UK, from the UK to the US, sorry. The race is from the Canadian border all the way down to Mexico. It is huge along the dividing range in America. And he was looking for a race to kind of, I guess, practice and a route to practice. And in America, they've got things like the Colorado Trail Race, which is sort of about half the distance of Tour Divide or a third or something like that. And there isn't anything in Europe that matches it. So he plotted the Highland Trail 550 route. It's often a bit more than 550 miles because of route changes and stuff like that. And he created this race, I want to say at least probably 10 years ago. Please correct me in the comments. And yeah, when he first started it, he also wanted to try and pitch it to be gender equal. So the equal number of entries for men and women. And this year they actually did that as well. So I think it's a really tough race full stop, but it's also opening up the idea that everybody can do these bonkers races. They might not be fast, but that's the point of it.
Why do, like, ultras in general, why do people want to go out there, sleep in a ditch, ride? I think people took around 4 days, like the really fast people took 4 days. Some people take up to eight, probably, maybe not as long. It's like you could go out there, you could book a holiday with Atlas Ride Co. You know, you sleep in your nice bed every night. They drop you off at the top of the mountain in Finale. You ride down, you have an espresso on the beach, maybe a couple grappers, you know. Why people love ultras? Because that seems a lot better to me. I like pedaling.
The why is a deeper, much deeper story. And as I've done a 24-hour race as part of a team, so I've got a microscopic window into sleep deprivation and racing. I think it comes back to the kind of like the mountaineer question of like, why do all these famous mountaineers and rock climbers and all these people, why do they do it?
Yeah.
Because it's there.
Yeah.
They can do it.
And I think there's something that like, I remember someone saying this about like things like Unbound. If you go to work Monday to Friday and you're always in your comfort zone, there's something about being outside your comfort zone and makes you think when you come back to work on Monday, you're like, I can do anything. If I can do 550 miles around the Highland Trail,
yeah,
a day in the office is a piece of cake, right?
And I think talking about work is really important because I think it's really fun. Like in the kind of like pre-show bants, you were kind of going, oh, Tour de France or Tour de insert Pro Tour roadie event. That's loads harder. And then you kind of prefaced it with like, oh, but they sleep in a ditch. And it's like, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, A, lots of these athletes aren't
professionals.
They're not professionals to an extent. Okay, the winner has got deals with, you know, people like Tailfin and with Trek. And I know, like, Kerry McPhee, who finished third overall, has got some, you know, assistance.
Support.
But it's not like a sponsorship deal like many people really have, like, others. So, I've completely lost my point in terms of
where we were talking about million-dollar racers with contracts earlier.
Oh.
So I guess this is a completely different world that it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a lifestyle as well. I suppose people are wanting to get out an adventure. And I do actually understand it, as much as I might take the mickey a bit. I can see, you know, I've gone through phases of life where I do really like the idea of doing these adventurous things and just not having to be accountable to a team manager or anyone.
Yeah.
Just do it because you want to do it.
I guess that loops back. Maybe I've found one of the threads of what I was talking about. It's like, if you're really good at riding a bike, but you maybe didn't get onto a Pro Tour team because of wherever, you know, all the issues with trying to get a ride on a pro team. And I can speak a little bit of this because I know Kerry vaguely. Mm. And she used to race cross country to a kind of like national level and to an international level, and trying to make it in mountain biking was really, really hard.
Yeah.
She loves riding a bike.
Yeah.
And it turns out she can ride really long and really fast.
Yeah.
Better than probably anybody else on the planet, bar a, you know, a handful. And it's this thing of how else do you kind of like do the thing that you love if you can't get a pro deal? And, and one of these FKTs and all these adventure races, yes, it's not pro in terms of people aren't paid, but it then opens up the opportunity for people who aren't pros to go and do it and be competitive. So it's fun.
It's also the other side of the coin to like high performance bike tech.
Yeah.
You know, high pivot. We can.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just, it doesn't really matter.
It's very simple,
isn't it? It's the athlete and it's what you do. You're not trying to sell the coolest new thing to someone who's watching that thing necessarily. There might be a bit of that. But I mean, this might be a subject for another week, Owen. But I went down a bit of a hole on YouTube the weekend.
Easily done.
In, do you know, Wood Cyclery down in the south of the UK?
Do you know the Wood Cyclery,
Kind of a retro bike adventure-y style shop. And this scene that is built around, well, it's quite a big thing worldwide, isn't it? Handmade bikes, steel bikes, titanium.
Yep.
And just the vibe of just going and riding a bike.
Not for performance.
No, just for a good time. And it's not necessarily a brand new, you know, all shining technology thing.
Well, I guess it's how we rank performance, isn't it? And I did a video just last weekend talking about weight. And yeah, to a degree, I'm sorry I triggered people out there by saying that weight isn't important.
Really? You triggered people?
I know, who would have thought? And it's this thing of performance. You're talking about it's not a high-performance bike, but it still performs really well. So there's, lots of these rigid ATBs.
We will. Really want to dig into this. We will go and do this, Owen. I can see me and you pedaling around. I've got my old mountain bike. You can get the updated sort of flavour of the same thing.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Anyway, from last week's show, we've got a couple of polls, which I think are quite funny. So first one is, what do you think of 32-inch wheels? Love it, 8%. Hate it, 24%. Don't care, 67%.
There we go. That's great.
I think that's as expected.
I think I was somewhere in the middle of hate it and don't care, but I quite like the don't
care. But I think it's fascinating. Again, on the comments of one of the videos we did last week on tech, so many people are kind of like, no, 32 is a horrid. And then we've got, 60% don't care?
Yeah, more. Yeah,
that's awesome. Yeah. It's great.
And do e-bikes make your bum smaller? Yeah. Yes, 56%. So it's not quite so black and white. Though.
Really?
I don't know. It's just over. I mean, big things have been decided on less. So.
Okay, it's non-conclusive. We'll have to do some more research.
I mean, that is a great video. I could see you doing that.
Yeah, I don't have a very big bum to start with, so maybe someone else. Ferg's got a pretty big bum.
Well, there we go. Tiny bum chat. Great. Right,
get into the comments. We had an awful lot. I think we had 350 comments on last week's show.
Jeez, so
lots of good debate. Lots for us to talk about, actually. So get involved there and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for watching.